In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
The tech wearables market is floundering. Are the big bets worth it? From SDPB, today is Friday, September 6th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we get technical with our Tech Talk experts. Kent Osborne, John T. Meyer, Jeff Litterick, and Amos Aesop are all with us. We will look back on a summer of wearables and how some companies lost big on small devices. Then the ads for AI also took a hit this summer with some notable misses in predicting what consumers want and what we're willing to try with generative artificial intelligence. Plus, are humans doomed to a future of lazy thinking and not knowing how to write because the robots are doing it all for us? We explore the ethics of the world we are creating. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're going to dive into all things tech today with SDPB's Tech Talk crew. Amos Aesop is Chief Security Officer at Exigent Solutions in Sioux Falls. John T. Meyer is Executive Director of Leadership South Dakota and founder of Leadmore. Kent Osborne is Director of Digital for SDPB. And Jeff Litterick is a Network and Security Architect for the state of South Dakota. We are connecting from Sioux Falls, Vermilion, and Pierre with the help of our engineers. And we will begin with the promise of wearables and their disappointing market performance. Here's John T. Meyer.
Yeah, so we hear a lot about AI, and one of the hopes is that, you know, I don't think AI will truly reach its potential until it can just exist in sort of, I guess, the background or just like kind of integrate into our life, right? Like,
sure.
We don't want to have to always type and interface through a chat. Like, and I think when things truly reach sort of product market fit is when they just are integrate into the software we already use. Like a good example is I'm working in a Google Docs and I start typing a sentence and then Google will suggest what might be the rest of my thought. And all I have to do is hit the space bar and it finishes the sentence. Mm-hmm. That's AI, but that's been in our like Google Docs for a while. I'm sure, Microsoft has it.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people have been trying to push, you know, the way innovation works is we push our ideas, push our products and services. Sometimes they work. Usually they don't first, and we have to iterate. And so there's been this growing product idea across a couple different companies, basically an AI wearable. We've seen it as a pin. I've seen it as like a necklace. A couple different products have come out. Basically, something's always listening to you. And I mean, it kind of gets pretty quickly to like a Black Mirror episode if you're familiar with the Netflix show.
Yeah.
But it's just something that's going to listen to your entire life. And so when you were like, what did I say to Amos yesterday when we were out the street, you know, walking out after our lunch, like I told him I would follow up with something. What was that? And this wearable would pick it up. Uh-huh. Sounds pretty interesting in theory, right? Sounds handy. Sounds helpful. Like be your second memory, essentially your second brain. They're just not working in the marketplace. I don't know if it's a technology issue, if it's a readiness, if it's sort of the awkwardness of, do you want to have a conversation with me or that I'm recording the entire time wearing something? And so one particular example, there's a company called Humane, which had a lot of hype. They had a former Apple designer. They had raised a ton of money, big kind of fancy commercial and launch, and it's just not going well. And recently the Times did a story about just how big of a flop this particular product has been.
Welcome to Humane.
This is the Humane AI Pin. It's a standalone device and software platform built from the ground up for AI.
Well, I wonder if some of the problem isn't the design, if we just need faster processors, because this thing is slow, like infuriatingly slow. And, you know, it's prone to overheating. It had terrible battery life. I just wonder, people don't want to use things that don't work.
True.
And this just didn't work.
It also was expensive, came with a subscription fee, had very little actual interesting AI capabilities to it, right? And the AI that it did have, a lot of time it had to reference, it had to go back to the internet or back to its own LLM. It wasn't self-contained. Mm-hmm. And so there was a delay there. And so you'd ask it a question,
I'm going to start by asking my PIN about something I asked it to remember for me. What time is my flight to New York? You can ask your PIN to remember your schedule, make lists, take notes,
search
really anything.
Your flight to New York is at 1 p.m.
There's this ice cream shop in New York that makes everything out of bananas. What's it called? Anything that you would search the web for or even use ChatGPT for, you can use on your PIN.
Makes everything out of bananas is called Morgenstern's Bananas.
It would sit, it would spin, you'd know it was doing something, and eventually it would come out. And Marquez Brown Lee, an online technology influencer, single worst product he's ever reviewed in the 9 years he's been doing this, right?
Well, I saw that was a big deal because his review, he can sink or swim a product, but him saying that, like, I saw there, it was just more bad news getting piled on.
Yeah. Just bottomed out.
Yeah.
Jeff, what are you seeing in this market and what are you noticing that this brings up for you?
Anything like this is also going to have the effect of the Google glasses from way back when.
Sure.
People don't like being recorded. They don't like being on video. They don't like being recorded, especially when they're unaware. They have it just a pushback on that kind of technology. And it seems to be pretty universal across most cultures that they just don't like that. So something that's recording all the time, either video or audio, is probably always going to be a very niche. And it just doesn't, none of them seem successful. They've tried this a few times and every single one seems to fail over time.
So. Yeah, I was thinking about that too. If you guys, if we hit the archive of the show, I was one of the people who got to go get a Google Glass about 10 plus years ago and I wore it and I got the reaction, just a couple times, the reactions I got from people on the street, I mean, middle fingers and cuss words.
Sure.
And I actually think this particular product, people might not even notice it. It's so subtle or people might not even know. Yeah. But that opens up a whole can of worms, too, of like, you know, I know certain states you can record phone calls and some you can't, and you have to disclose that. And
so the first problem is that it didn't really work, which is what Kent said. So it didn't do the thing that they were promising that it would do. And the second thing is the thing that they're promising it would do, perhaps we've already decided we either don't want.
Either we don't want or we're not ready for
it. Or we're not ready for.
Yeah.
In some ways. But we're ready for smartwatches, Kent. We're ready for Fitbits. We're ready for GPS in our cars. What are some of the ways? We're ready for some kind of biofeedback devices that tell us our blood pressure is too high or our blood sugar is spiking. What are we ready for and what's working in the wearable market, Kent?
Well, I'm ready for that because my watch actually told me I was an AFib and I should go see my doctor. And we're working on that.
Are you?
Yeah. And so, I
mean,
not right now, this minute.
Okay, I thought you meant right now. It's a very stressful show.
No.
We will pause. But this happened.
Let's come back after a break.
Your device helped you in a medical emergency, is what you're telling me.
Yeah, okay. Well, it let me know that I should go seek some more help.
Okay, yeah.
Which I did, and we have a plan.
Yeah.
So everything's good there. But, you know, it's going back to, you know, when it's useful for me, that's when I use something. And it isn't, you know, when I try to force technology on myself because, you know, I really need to use this because everybody else is, it doesn't work for me. But when there's something useful there, so I was just thinking about the previous conversation about the wearables and things. Well, I'm already wearing a wearable, and that's that watch that you know, tells me my heart rate. And if it's too high or too low, it lets me know. You know, most of the time I know because my heart is beating out of my chest, and I kind of know that. But when it's low, I like to know that too. And so it's very useful. But, you know, and I think maybe, again, with the previous conversation, it needs to be integrated in what I'm already used to using, my phone, my watch. So whether that's an Apple product or a Samsung product or a Fitbit, if it's already something I'm using, I'm probably going to be more willing to use more of the features of that product. It's probably going to be easier. It's probably going to be better designed. I don't know about, you know, the particular pin and other things that people were talking about because I didn't ever try them. Yeah. But I'm wondering if by the time it reaches mass market, it has the power it needs to do things. It's not going to overheat. It's not going to be slow. Chances are. I just think once the technology matures in this area, it's just going to be a better experience and people are going to be more receptive to it.
Which gets me to this question. John T., how hard is it for a new company to break in, which is what the race is, I won't say violence, but the hyper-competitiveness of the race to be the person who's in your house. It's got to be incredibly hard for a company you haven't heard of.
Yeah, it's incredibly hard. We live in an era of just, you know, the 5-6 tech giants, and in kind of an antitrust era, it's almost impossible to beat these companies. So product design is long, it's slow, it's market adoption, it's marketing, it's trend. You know, Apple, you could argue Apple also has sort of a failed wearable product, which is the Vision Pro. Mm-hmm. Now, that's more in the Google Glass category that Jeff mentioned. I've heard it's amazing. Unlike Humane, this product is good and it's well made, but people also aren't just sitting at home in their couch wearing goggles. Right? So no surprise, right? And so Apple can afford to miss on that version one and iterate and rebuild and figure out how, I mean, I still think it's in the, directionally, it's probably right. Like, we are going to have wearables, and this sounds scary, but someday probably even in our bodies, to what the category of what Kent's talking about with our health. But so directionally, I think it's right, but Apple can afford to miss and iterate, whereas a Humane likely won't survive.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of that is the need to be frictionless, right? The fact that wearing goggles at home using the Apple product is a significant departure from what you're used to doing, and it's something you have to consciously go do. Whereas if there is something that is just a small change or no change at all, the most powerful, best AI that I use today is a integration with our Zoom and Teams and WebEx meetings, where it sits and takes notes for us based on everybody talking, and then it summarizes and puts into bullet points, and these are the 10 things you need to do, and it is unbelievably accurate. But it didn't require me to change what I was doing.
You installed it and nothing else.
It was just something that shows up as another caller on the line, and now I get the benefit, and I don't have to make a departure from what my normal daytime activities are. I think that so Amazon just announced a new AI version of Alexa, which is going to be a pay-for version, but people now have had Alexa in their homes for 10 or 11 years.
Yeah.
It's not going to be that much different. And so there, I think, is going to be slightly frictionless updates to your AI. The subtle working its way into your life, I think, is the right way to go about it, as opposed to making a new change in physical activity that you have to do in order to use that AI.
And you're at work, so people in a meeting, and people have already pretty much agreed that in a meeting we're all listening to each other. And so an AI...
Well, I will say that
transcript or summary of the tasks at our hand isn't opposed to that? Or
occasionally they are.
Okay.
It's not very often, but every now and then someone will say, you know, what is that note taker that's here?
Yeah.
And we'll say it's an AI thing that is recording everything and summarizes the notes, and you'll get a copy too. And some people have said, I'm not comfortable with that, and so we have to kick the note taker out. It happens. People, you know, we talked about this before the show started. There's a bit of paranoia out there, and rightfully so, because, I mean, all the things that you should be paranoid about, it's tough to determine the things that you shouldn't be paranoid about. And maybe there's no defined line there. Maybe it's a mixture of the two.
Jeff Litterick, how is that where we're headed, where someone's just going to, we're going to get all really comfortable with saying, I'd like to opt out of that, versus flipping JT off when he's wearing goggles like John T.
I mean, we do now on Zoom meetings. We can record Zoom meetings or team meetings today, and we do a lot for, you know, history of people who miss meeting stuff. But there's every once in a while, you know, people do not want to be recorded.
Yeah.
And it kind of gets back to that whole thing. As far as wearables go, I'm kind of the poster child for medical wearables. I'm diabetic, so I have stuff implanted. I have stuff poked in that I change every couple of weeks, all tied to my phone with AI monitoring, you know, blood pressure, heartbeats, sleep cycles, blood sugar levels, all that stuff. And took a little bit of time, but I got very comfortable with it. And to be honest, it's especially on the medical side, it dramatically improves your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's a humongous win. And when you get those kind of wins, people will become much more comfortable with it. If they see a real impact on how they live and their health and stuff, they will embrace that technology. But if they don't see that, or they get pushback, then they will tend to dismiss it or not want to use it also.
Yeah. So I want to ask you a couple questions about that, Jeff, and you know, which is, how close is it to being like a smart doctor with you? Is it what What are the, where do you want it to be 5 years from now, for example? What do you need that you don't have, even though you're already using this technology as a health monitoring function in your life? What else do you need from it that hasn't been rolled out yet?
Well, it's kind of rolling out, and that's predictivity, right?
Okay.
Where it looks at my stress level, it looks at my sleep cycle, and it says, you know what, you need to take extra insulin tomorrow, or you need to adjust your medicines tomorrow because you're either going to go low or high, and we can predict that. And it's starting to get kind of like that, where it can predict out in the future with trends and stuff, kind of a little bit more manually. But that's what I really want to see is, you know what, from your past stress levels and past history and what we've analyzed with you, we predict that this is going to happen tomorrow to your blood sugars or blood pressure and stuff, and you can be proactive on that kind of stuff. And it's getting there, and like I said, it really changes your health and life when you start using the tools and really start monitoring and kind of listen to their advice as they go. They're not perfect, and I just actually had a blood sugar sensor that thought I was dead because it was telling me I had 10 blood sugar when I was really at 60. So, and I had to throw that away. So you can't totally trust it yet, but and you get a dead every once in a while, but for the most part, it really is an improvement.
Yeah.
So especially sleep cycles.
Sure.
Just knowing that you had a restless sleep the night before really determines a lot of what's going to happen the next day while you're awake.
Yeah.
So,
and Kent, there's one more thing I want to add before we take a quick break about this. We need it to be accurate. We need it to be integrated into our lives in a way that makes sense to us. We also need it to be private, especially when we're talking about healthcare. And as the woman around the table, you know, we're talking about women's cycles, for example, or perimenopause, or, you know, pregnancy development. And women desperately want that to be private information that they know no one can use against them in the future. For various reasons, people want and deserve privacy in their healthcare, and now we're attached to certain devices or we're logging things on devices. What are the challenges there?
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought this up. What we're seeing right now is, you know, the European Union has, you know, kind of been the leader in the whole privacy part of all of this. And recently, both Meta and Apple, with Apple's Apple Intelligence, have basically said, we're going to stop working on some of this AI because we need the European Union, we need their data to help train the AI. And EU's laws are so broad and so complex that they don't know if they're going to get sued or not if they use certain data.
Right.
And so, you know, has that privacy or that, you know, it's a desire to keep everybody safe. I understand that. But, you know, has it swung too far when it comes to the way the EU has taken things? And would a better approach be, let's have some guiding principles. Let's not have all these laws. Let's just all sit down and decide, this is how we're going to operate, and these are the rules, I think, without such laws and things like that. So we got to get to a place where, you know, because this is all still developing, and everything that's happening with Jeff and myself, you know, my CPAP machine gives me a report every morning on the app, and so does my bed. And it's like I've got all this data, and I'm sharing it with all the other things in all my other apps and that are tracking my macros for what I'm eating and that are, you know, my weight and everything else. I mean, it all fuses together, sometimes a little bit wonky right now,
right.
But that'll all come. But that's got all those different things have to share data. And I think there's all failure points there for security and other things. And you have to be allow other companies to see your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, we got to get to the point where we have a set of rules and everybody plays by them. And if you want to have these benefits, you know, Jeff and I are two examples of how these things are benefiting our lives every single day.
Yeah.
And if you want the benefits, you got to give a little. And that's understanding that your privacy, you know, might go a little far. I don't know that anybody's misusing my data. But I know I have to click through a lot of, I understand this, and I understand I'm sharing screens.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about all I understand. I just want it to work.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm looking for help, and I need help, and it just, I just need it to work.
You're listening to In the Moment on SCPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're back with our Tech Talk panel. We're going to move from the life-changing and life-saving function of wearables to the marketing and consumer use of AI. Well, this summer, dozens of AI ads popped up online, on streaming platforms, on broadcast TV during the Olympics, and one in particular caught a lot of people's attention.
My little girl's always been a runner, just like me. I've always thought she was following in my footsteps.
Hey, go get him, baby.
But lately, she's been looking up to someone else. She might even be the world's number one Sydney fan. And like Sydney, she's focused on her technique.
Good job, baby. Accelerate out the curb. High knees, high knees. There you go.
She wants to show Sydney some love, and I'm pretty good with words, but this has to be just right. So Gemini, help my daughter write a letter telling Sydney how inspiring she is. And be sure to mention that my daughter plans on breaking her world record one day. She says, sorry, not sorry.
There was a huge consumer backlash where people were criticizing that idea of that's what this would be used for. And the ad was pulled. Let's start with Kent Osborne and tell me a little bit about what was happening this summer that we saw so many of these ads pushed at us online and even on broadcast television.
Well, I'm going to take a guess. And my guess is that they really, really want you to use these services. And part of the reason is probably monetary money is money. Probably some of it is they want to know what people want to know. They want to be able to feed the data. But what they're finding is that millions of people are trying this stuff. And a lot of them aren't coming back. So they had their taste, they had their sample, and they're not using the service. And I think, you know, they've put billions with a B into all this. I think, if we get into VR and other things later, you know, 50 billion in that so far, but they're putting a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of research, and they're not seeing the payoff.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why we're seeing the ads. We're seeing a desperation to get people to use this stuff. And until it's useful, you know, they're not going to. We're not going to. But the minute it becomes useful, it becomes that, I don't want to use the word crutch, but, you know, if it helps me with my spreadsheet, because I don't really know what I'm doing with spreadsheets, that's fantastic. I'm gonna continue using that maybe till I learn how to do it better myself.
Yeah.
Or my writing skills. I'm not the most, you know, I couldn't write a poem for you probably without AI right now. But if I need to do that, it's there for me. But I know that.
Yeah. So John T., when I was watching those ads, there was not one thing that I heard that I thought, oh, that's for me.
Sure.
You know, help design a training plan so I can run my first 5K. Help, you know, take a picture of the food on the counter and come up with a recipe for it. Write a letter for me. A lot of generative stuff. Write this for me. Write this for
yeah.
me. And as someone who is not need nor want a machine to write for me, because that's one of my favorite things to do, and
sure.
it's a great skill that I have. I don't need that. It seemed to me like they didn't have imagination in helping sell me that there was some kind of function to my life. What's going on?
Yeah, I think one of the things when we have these big technology waves, the big players, the giants we were talking about, it's so dangerous and risky for them to be. It's just better to be too early than to be too late.
Okay.
Right. And so
yeah.
I think everyone's jockeying. Zuckerberg can tell shareholders, we've invested this much in AI, and Microsoft will say, this is our number one priority. And Google will say, like, we feel like we are in the lead. And they're probably just going to burn a lot of cash. But that's okay,
yeah.
because if they're too late, then it's a whole different story. And it's a whole different narrative that they have to share to their shareholders. And so I always joke, like, when we look at the dot-com bubble, like, say, pets.com,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
All of those ideas that came out in 99, 2000, like, they exist today. Like we go online and order our dog food. They just were too early in 2000, right? We just like our previous segment, we weren't ready for them. And so I think it's interesting because everyone's jockeying for a position and saying, hey, you could do this and you could do that. And what you're saying is right. It's like, I don't know if I really want to. Like,
yeah.
As a father, I think there was the Google one. Like, I'm just going to write a letter to my daughter myself instead of let a computer do it for me.
Or I'm going to teach my daughter how to write a letter. The whole point of that was
the Olympics.
That if your daughter wants to write a fan letter, you shouldn't be teaching her to have the computer write a fan letter
because
it wasn't good enough. The dad was like, your letter isn't good enough. AI will
do it. A little tone deaf there.
Gemini will do it better.
Advertising.
Amos, what do you see the future and the promises outside of you know, health? And curing cancer and, you know, doing some of the big things that want safety in your vehicle.
Well, these are certainly the ideal goals of using AI and the amount of vast information that we have and the processing power that it has and the ability to learn over time. But today, with a few exceptions, most of the AI available to the general public is text-based. Right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're willing to pay a little bit of money, you can use some of the more advanced generators of images. In fact, we didn't even touch on, you know, the political stuff where you're seeing images created of the various candidates in situations that they've never been in.
Right.
But the pictures certainly look real. But the majority of folks are going to have access to the text-based ones where you can say, please write me a letter, even if that letter happens to be tone deaf. But you have the ability to say, please save me some time by creating the shell of a letter. I will then edit it and make it be exactly what I want. But and that's where a lot of it's being used in the workplace today, too. We were talking off air about being able to write speeches or being able to write sermons or whatever it happens to be. And if there's something that would normally take you 3 hours to do to get perfected, but you can get it done in 25 minutes, I don't know that that's so much a terrible thing because you're no longer thinking. You're just using your tools that you have to your advantage. And certainly we all understand that AI is not perfect, that there's, you know, it's going to bring back maybe some wrong information. You're going to have to tweak. You're going to have to fact check, those sorts of things. But it's another tool that you can use to become more efficient and save time. You just need to make sure that, you know, you're using it appropriately. I do understand the idea of having a 7-year-old write a letter, probably part of human development, right? That's also why we teach a lot of things in schools that maybe you won't learn or you won't use explicitly when you become an adult. It's part of learning how to learn. But at some point, I think people were angry too when we started using typewriters and computers because the art of handwriting was going to go away. And it has, but not maybe to the detriment of society.
Here's what I'm going to kick this to you in a second here, but here's the other thing when you say we ought to have rules. You know, maybe if we don't have laws, we ought to have expectations or how we have agreed to do things. And transparency, to me, is one of the things that if you write a poem and you read it to me, or if you give a sermon and I sit in the pew and listen to it, or if you write a song and I enjoy it, I would like transparency to know that came through a certain pathway. And I know that maybe I'm in the minority of that, but I still feel, and I think a lot of teachers are struggling with this, and where is the line, Kent, where you just, fine, if you're not feeling uncomfortable that you use the technology, then tell me that you use the technology.
Yeah, I don't know where that line is, and I guess I don't know how to cross it or uncross it because, I'm sorry to get back to the original question with John T. But the answer for me is I use this stuff when I'm out of my wheelhouse. I mean, I've been asked to do a task that I just can't do,
mm-hmm.
and that is maybe writing something or the imagery that Amos talked about. I descriptively tell the program what I want, and it gives me a beautiful graphic that I can use in my promotions for this thing that I'm trying to do. So it makes me more useful in my productivity. The other thing is I like to double check my work. When I'm giving a presentation and I have all the things that I'm thinking about, I write them from my perspective and my point of view. And sometimes that gets in my way, and I forget about things that maybe Lori would have thought about, or somebody else would have thought about, or maybe another, another audience, let's just say the folks that are hard of hearing, or, mm-hmm. you know, some other thing that I may or may not be. Right. But it gives me that double check on what I'm presenting and saying, oh, yeah, then there's, and I forgot about these other things because I'm so wrapped up in my own world that I forgot about all these other perspectives and I forgot about all these other features and things. And those are the two times when I've, you know, particularly used AI to help me either in my personal or in my career. And am I supposed to put a footnote there and say, hey, you know, some big, you know, large language model helped me do this? I don't know how to communicate that, I guess, to people other than just say, you know, hey, you know, yeah. this was with the help of AI. I'm not sure how I'm supposed to do that yet.
Jeff, before we go to break, thoughts on transparency and when you let people know you're using, you know, something and when you don't.
Well, there's been talk about watermarking any AI output, yeah. especially from the large language and art and video and sound kind of stuff. Because the AI sound stuff is so good that it takes a humongous computer to even determine if it's fake anymore. So some kind of watermarking technology where, you know, people can identify it. Because you know, one of the things we haven't talked about AI that the ads are probably trying to give a good impression of is the cyber criminals are using massive amounts of AI. The amount of AI phishing and like fake resumes and scams and everything else is humongous. This summer, it's jumped 100-fold what we're seeing. And a lot of it is all AI generated because it's easy, fast, and efficient. And it actually makes the old, you know, joke about phishing or misspelled words and bad grammar that don't exist anymore. Many times you cannot tell the difference between a real and a bad email. And people are starting to get really caught up in this from the AI generation. So,
so how do you protect, AI, you know, so. in IT, how do you protect from those bad actors? Because we're all just people who rely on you to keep us out of trouble.
It's getting super hard and harder every day. And that's why there's been also a big push for watermarking, not just for legitimate uses, but then for illegitimate uses, people can determine that real fast. You know, my friend Fred did not send me this email.
Right.
Because it's AI generated.
One thing I'd love to see in our education system, you know, you talked about the loss of handwriting, or like, I know they don't teach keyboarding anymore.
Yeah.
Right. I think we do need to have some sort of like digital literacy course in our education system, because what's not going to stop are these fakes and, you know, the ability to like understand that an article maybe wasn't from a journalistic source or has this AI slant, or, you know, this photo of 100,000 people at a place, is it real, is it not real? Like, we need to have some sort of basic level foundational kind of digital literacy skills.
And I want to be able to opt out. When I do a search on my phone, it gives me the AI response. I don't know where it's coming from. I want to go to, you know, vet my own sources. And so I want that off. I want that off my phone, and I don't think I have an option right now. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's jump back into our Tech Talk conversation with the idea of security and the power of AI when used for good and when leveraged by bad actors. Let's start with Kent Osborne and Jeff Litterick.
Are people able to use AI against AI for security reasons? Is there white hat AI and black hat AI, and you can pit one against the other to help, or is this human versus machine right now?
No, it is AI versus AI. The amount of logging and I'm not kidding about the thousandfold. We get reports from the Fusion Center and FBI, and they're seeing it all across South Dakota and the whole region. The amount of this stuff is increasing exponentially over the summer.
Yeah.
And to be honest, without AI on our side, there's no way we can shift through this stuff and make sense of the data and find this stuff. So almost all of our security tools, in fact, all of our security tools are heavily invested in AI themselves to be able to do pattern analysis, to do a lot of this stuff. And even our network tools for network traffic pattern and stuff to determine security stuff is all going to massive AI. And that's kind of why HP is buying Juniper, because Juniper has a massive AI networking infrastructure.
Yeah, yeah. We're seeing that in gaming too. So if the only way they know if people are cheating is they've got AI watching people and say, oh, that was impossible. He can't do that, or he or she can't do that. And then they ban them for cheating, because that's the only way they can catch this stuff, is the one's catching the other.
Hmm. Yeah, in fact, current story was there's an AI now that can hallucinate playing Doom all the way through, kind of in its sleep cycles. So to learn to play games and how to play them and catch the cheaters and stuff like that.
So what's the point? The machine can play the game by itself. What is the game for?
It's improving the AI and what else it can do, right? It's kind of, at this point in the marketplace, to get investment, you have to prove your AI can do something. And the flashier it is, the more investment dollars you're getting.
Yeah.
So a lot of AI isn't flashy. A lot of AI is kind of homegrown, kind of behind the scenes, just doing its job and working. But that doesn't grab investment dollars. So those stories where they're always pushing AI or making a splash, right, when Microsoft announces they have an AI sound generator they wrote, at least because it's so good, not even a supercomputer can tell it's fake. That's all about hyping the stuff up to get investment dollars.
And the sound generator is for what? What's the purpose?
Human voices.
Human voices, yeah.
Microsoft has one that now could take three words you've spoken and basically impersonate you to where a supercomputer would be required to determine if it's really your voice or not.
Yeah, I hate that.
I used it. There's one called 11labs.com, and I recorded a marketing video, and it was a little clip I put on Instagram and social media, and it was about a webinar I was doing in late August. And then what happened is, because of my calendar, I had to switch the date of the webinar. And so my video editor said, I have enough audio here. I'm going to just plug this into 11labs and change. Instead of saying August 15th, we said August 16th. And it sounds exactly like me. Like I could play it to you right now. You wouldn't even notice. And all they need is a couple of minutes of your audio. And guess what? I have a podcast, so I have a lot of minutes of my audio, of my voice on the internet. It's indistinguishable.
Yeah.
Video is real close behind it if they have video clips of you.
Yeah.
Not perfect yet, but it's getting there.
And I just don't think that should be – I'm going to speak for all the people who think that shouldn't be allowed. I mean, I understand. And this – remember the movie WALL-E? You know, where the people were just, they were all obese and they like scooted around in these little, you know, devices. And the whole idea was that human beings had just given up. And it's a pretty good movie, you know, sort of spinning this out. And then the robots become the humans and help bring people back to, you know, life because they've gotten so lazy.
Yep.
Leaving Earth's cleanup in the hands of one incredible machine. WALL-E.
But this idea that if we're not doing these things, we're not learning. And if we're not, and I, as a, you know, as someone who has a show, the fact that people use my voice and then keep the show going and send me home, this is my job. And we are creating something authentic. We're all physically in a place right now having a conversation and people are listening to us. So we have created something for the people of South Dakota in public broadcasting. As we sort through these ideas, if you take that away and just use my voice to say things that you think I would have said, and then I'm supposed to just check it and go, yeah, that's what I would have said. Like, no, I'm changing what I say. I'm making mistakes. I'm going back and changing my mind. I don't like it, Amos.
Absolutely.
And that's why there's been all these strikes.
Yeah.
By the screenwriters, the actors. Yeah. In fact, there's a voice actors are striking video game companies right now for the same reason.
Yeah.
It's all about AI protections.
Amos, go ahead.
Well, the first thing that came to mind there with the voice actors is, you know, all of the animations that we have with Family Guy and The Simpsons and Archer and all that sort of stuff. They've got enough audio there. They would never need to employ those actors again.
True.
You did not agree when you signed up to do that.
That's the
people who do come in and say, oh, no, I'll do that for you. I'll replace this person by giving you, you know, 2 hours of my voice, and then you can make me say whatever you want. they're both bad scenarios.
They are.
Help me not be depressed about all of this, gentlemen.
And it is a fine line because, you know, Carrie Fisher died. They brought her back using AI. Yeah. I mean, they call it special effects, but it was really AI to finish up those Star Wars movies. So
I saw a meme recently that said, like, soon you'll be able to stay in a hotel in space. And then the person retweeted it and was like, all we wanted was healthcare.
Right.
And it makes me think it's sort of a byproduct of, like, guess what? Life's pretty good in 2024. Like, we've all got really comfortable. And so now we're innovating on the margins of these things that, like, we maybe don't actually really want or care about.
Well,
the one thing I'll say, though, on the job front is that history does tell us when new technology knocks out, like, an industry or a job, it also often creates new jobs that we don't yet know. So, like, my daughter's in third grade, and the stat that they say, I don't know how they figure this stuff out, but it's that 50% of the jobs that Margot will do when she graduates don't even exist yet. So I can be like, hey, Margot, do you want to be a doctor, a vet, a lawyer? Like, all the other choices, I don't even know what they are because they haven't yet been named or created.
I want to close with this concept, too, as you know, as we go off on that thread, but also there is this idea of schools in 2024 banning cell phone usage or restricting it. And there's a group in Sioux Falls, it's like low-tech families. And so you're using technology to find other people who want to limit the way we use technology. And I know, Kent, you and I have talked about some of the devices I have that go back to, you know, the equivalent of a watch that you would wind. Like, what is the opposite of a smartwatch? And then you go by that. What is the opposite of a laptop? You know, it's a typewriter. People will also resist that in small, not lucrative for any company pockets probably. But how are human beings making those kinds of somewhat defiant, even if only marginally, choices? Ken?
There was just a great report on NPR this morning that talked about how they, you know, they have these extremely expensive pouches that they're putting these phones into that lock them for the day, and then you can unlock them at the end of the day, and how much value the teachers have even seen in that in the last 2 weeks of their interactions with other human beings are starting to come back, that they're the thing that they haven't seen in a very, very long time after post-COVID. They haven't seen this amount of interaction because they got rid of the phones and the constant dings from this notification, that notification, and so I think that's a really good thing. It's been interesting over the summer to follow the South Dakota legislature. They've had a committee on use of technology. Basically, let's just get down to the points. Use of technology in classrooms. It's about AI and other things and all that, but how do you get kids prepared for this future by not immersing them in it? So how do you take the phone away but leave the laptop there? And you know, I understand where people want to get to, and some of that is restricting technology so that you learn it yourself or you learn in a different way. But then again, how do you integrate this stuff and find the balance?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the hard part, is the balance. How do you get there without, how do you eat the Doritos without, you know, getting to be 400 pounds? I don't know. I'm yeah, still trying to figure that out.
You know that you don't. That's the answer.
Don't put the Doritos almost in your face.
Yeah, almost all those new jobs are going to require those skills, right? So you got to train
what
them
skills?
Somehow. Well, skills in AI, skills in technology.
So the technological skills they need to have, not just the analytical skills and the thoughtful ethical skills and the being a human skills. It also, you're also going to have to know how this stuff works.
Yeah.
Is what
an
you're saying.
Interesting thing, because we just had a big kind of conference on this, that the age of the computer program is gone. Nobody's going to write code here anymore.
Yeah.
AI can write code better, faster, and more efficient. But what you do need is someone to be analytical about the code and the design requirements and stuff. So you're going to get more designers versus people just writing code. So the AI will actually force more analytical stuff at the upper level, but the raw code level stuff is gone.
Hmm.
What ChatGPT can write in well over 300 different computer languages and actually convert from one language to another in a few seconds, entire apps and programs. I mean, So skills are going to change, right? But people need to be aware. But it may be in the end become more an analytical type job environment that's required than it is even today in some regards. So
here's one of the things.
Basically that, overseeing the AI.
And as we wrap, overseeing, and as we wrap up, I want to go back to something that Kent was saying about things that are not in your wheelhouse. And this is something that I think is useful for everybody to meditate on. When somebody is using AI to write a poem, for example, not everybody needs to write poetry, right? But there is something happening here as we're all confronting the things that we don't know how to do. And how are we going to do the things that we don't want to do when we're under pressure, when we don't have time, when we don't want to get, I mean, I'm not going to do long division. I don't want to do long division. It's a very basic example, but I'm going to go look at a calculator for that. And I have anxiety about math, and having a calculator is a very quick way to get past that and not feel like a math idiot. And some people are doing that with writing. That's not my story, but it might be somebody else's. And so if we can, at the very least, John T., give space for people as they are stressed about this, or as they are worried about their health, or as they are facing the pressure of a test or a sermon or a love letter, mm-hmm. that maybe we can at least hold that bit of humanity in our hands.
Yeah, right. I think the skill that you want, I thought what Amos said earlier was important, is the learn how to learn, right? Mm-hmm. And so you find your expertise and the things that give you joy, and you figure out how to kind of adapt as this stuff adapts with us. My favorite little joke I saw on this is, like, I wanted AI to do my laundry so that I could do my hobbies. And right now AI is doing our hobbies, so we have to go do our laundry, right? Like, I want Rosie from the Jetsons to come physically and do mm-hmm. my laundry, and then I can go spend time making music or writing poetry, or that's what I would prefer to write.
Yeah.
And so we'll figure it out. It just needs to autocorrect a little bit.
We always get nervous at the advent of new technology that it's going to go the wrong direction and it's going to make our lives worse. And I guess you could argue that some have, but in general, we tend to find a way to make things better. So yeah. In 10 years, we'll look back on this conversation and say, gosh, we just didn't know what we didn't know, did we?
All right. We'll leave it there. Thank you guys so much. Amos Aesop is Chief Security Officer at Exigent Solutions in Sioux Falls. John T. Meyer is Executive Director of Leadership South Dakota and founder of Lead More. Kent Osborne is Director of Digital for SDPB. Jeff Litterick is a network and security architect for the state of South Dakota. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. On Mondays in the Moment, when Basil Gooden was a young man leaving the cattle ranch in Virginia, his father took him aside and told him to find opportunity, he would have to look elsewhere. But why can't rural kids find the American dream in the places they call home? Well, Gooden grew up to become USDA Undersecretary for Rural Development, and we'll talk with him about his recent visit to South Dakota. Plus, South Dakota farmers fly into Washington to have their say on the delay of a new farm bill. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester. Our executive producer is Kara Hetland. Our videographer is Jordan Henderson. Our engineering support comes from Colton Nicholson. I'm Lori Walsh. From all of us here at SDPB, we thank you for listening.